Well, Republican presidential candidates used the Sunday talk shows to question President Obama's credentials as commander-in-chief. Herman Cain and Rick Perry called pulling American troops out of Iraq by the end of the year a mistake, even though that deadline was established by Republican George W. Bush and held by Obama only after Iraqi officials refused to give American troops immunity from prosecution after that deadline. On Fox News, Texas Governor Rick Perry said Obama's foreign policy was wavering and aimless. And as to Libya, where NATO is ending its mission today, Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann said the U.S. shouldn't have participated, despite the death of Muammar Gaddafi, because the outcome is still unknown. And she cited Defense Secretary Robert Gates as someone who had early reservations about the mission. It's known that both Secretary Gates and Vice President Biden did voice reservations about getting involved in Libya. While the strange bedfellows, left-leaning human rights activists like Samantha Power and right-wing neocons like Elliot Abrams, the former George Bush advisor, pushed the president for all-out intervention to prevent what they said would be genocide. So how did President Obama navigate this tug over war? Reporter Michael Hastings goes inside Obama's war room in an article in Rolling Stone magazine. He's working on a new book, so we're very pleased that Michael has the time to talk to us. Michael, welcome, and take us inside that war room.
Anyone looking at the Libya situation from the American perspective, you'd be nuts not to be somewhat skeptical, right? But on the other side of that, you have, as you said, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, who are these intellectuals whose experience was formed by their memories of the 90s when you had the Balkans and Rwanda and these sort of horrible cases of ethnic cleansing. And they had this group of people and the neocons as well had come up with this sort of theory, this intellectual framework to say, look, America's role in the world should be to try to prevent these sorts of humanitarian disasters.
It was a theory called R2P, responsibility to protect, that Susan Rice, and we should say she was the president's UN ambassador, who'd felt that she'd been part of the administration, the Clinton administration, when it failed to push for intervention in Rwanda. And now she had this R2P, responsibility to protect.
And you have President Obama. And now President Obama, it's quite interesting. On the one hand, as we know, he's very pragmatic, very wary of getting involved in another war in the Middle East. But the sort of split side of his personality is that he's a guy who has surrounded himself with these humanitarian interventionists. In fact, and if you go back and read President Obama's memoir, he even talks about during the 80s, though some of his liberal friends really didn't like what Reagan was doing in Central and South America, he sort of felt an affinity towards that, even though there were some bad human rights business going on. But this idea that America should be aggressive in its posture in the world. And so you have these sort of a confluence of influences on President Obama. And he essentially, as he was making up his mind, he was in the Situation Room right when the Libyan revolt was starting. He was given these intelligence reports about this potential massacre. And essentially he said, look, I understand. You know, there have been worse massacres and we've done nothing. There are worse people than even Gaddafi. We don't have necessarily a vital national interest there, but it's the right thing to do. And I believe as a president, especially a president who has taken a beating often for not being decisive enough on the domestic front, when he had this opportunity, you know, sort of in this foreign policy realm to really make a tough decision, he did it. And as he's done with the killing of bin Laden, as well as these other programs in the war on terror.
Well, but there was, you know, leading up to this decision, and you describe, you know, long, long meetings. This is over a long period of time. The president listening to these two sides literally go at each other in these meetings. There was an elephant in the room when there was this question of genocide, which human rights activists like Samantha Power were really concerned about. There was also the whiff of WMDs, you know, this idea of, are we going to go on false premises?
I think the genocidal threat that war proponents were claiming at the time, that this was going to be a Rwanda or this was going to be like the Balkans, I think that was wildly overblown. That being said, there clearly was going to be some significant amount of violence done against Libyan rebels and potentially Libyan civilians. I think war proponents went too far in their characterizations of what was going to happen in order to whip up support, which caused them problems, right? Because people immediately said, look, this is going to be bad, but it's not going to be genocide, which hurt their credibility, certainly, for the months until Tripoli fell.
Well, and also the president seemed to say there's no way we're going it alone. Explain that thinking.
And this is what I think the legacy of the president's Libyan intervention is going to be, especially as we look forward to the other, those Republican candidates who you heard at the beginning of the segment. Essentially, you get your friends, you get your allies, you get everybody involved before you make this sort of momentous decision, so then you're not the one left holding the bag if things go badly. And if things go well, yeah, you have to share in the success, but that's not too high a price to pay. I mean, look, Libya could still totally unravel, and we don't know what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, in terms of the American foreign policy track record, we'll have spent maybe $1 billion and had no American boots on the ground, yet we had succeeded in terms in the policy goals that they set out to do. That, to me, is the biggest takeaway from this, and that is the biggest takeaway. It's not necessarily the humanitarian intervention part as much as what White House officials call burden sharing, reimagining America's role in the world where we don't always have to pay the cost of these great security burdens.
And yet, did the president or his people in that war room plan enough contingencies? You say that it was not necessarily a bad thing that it took longer than expected for rebels to overcome Gaddafi because they really didn't have a plan for Gaddafi falling immediately.
I think that was one of the most shocking things as I started to report this story. Look, I'll be honest. When I found out, obviously when I was following the news and we were intervening in Libya, I said, okay, well, that's great. In 6 months from now, I'm going to do a story that's called, America's Next Disaster in the Middle East. And I was sort of shocked that it actually turned out somewhat okay and has. But yeah, I think if Gaddafi would have fallen right away, there would have been a larger chance for chaos. In this case, you had the Libyan rebels. They had, 6-7 months to get some sort of plan to get better organized. And so when Gaddafi does finally fall, there's somewhat a better chance for them to transition somewhat peacefully. Plus, Iraq was in the background of all this, right? Like, we didn't plan for post-war Iraq.
Well, and you say that came to haunt not only the Obama war room going forward, but, of course, Iraqis themselves. We'll have a link to Michael Hastings' Rolling Stone story, Inside Obama's War Room, at hereandnow.org. And when we come back, what was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's role here and now?
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Hastings, whose story in Rolling Stone, Inside Obama's War Room, details how President Obama came down the middle of competing forces to respond to the crisis in Libya without putting U.S. boots, other than CIA agents, on the ground in Libya. The story starts with the French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, BHL as he's known in France, who took up the cause of the Libyan rebels last spring and arranged a meeting between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the leader of the Libyan rebels. That didn't go so well. Clinton sided with Defense Secretary Robert Gates, both leery of intervention. But eventually, Michael, you write that Clinton comes to agree with Samantha Power, the Obama campaign advisor who so famously called Hillary Clinton a monster during the 2008 campaign.
For the first time on a major foreign policy question, Secretary Clinton breaks with Secretary Gates, right? She had been on almost all the other major questions. She had been arm in arm with Secretary Gates. But she decides, in this case, to become more aggressive in terms of arguing for intervention. And I think that happened because as she was traveling around the region and in Europe, she believed that here is an opportunity for us to do something where, again, we don't necessarily need to be the ones who are taking all the burden. And, in fact, there was just a story in the Washington Post called Hillary's War that Hillary was directly responsible for getting the Arab League on board, and that was a critical step. And I think it gave President Obama comfort knowing that another major figure was going to back this.
So, Michael Hastings, you say in conclusion that President Obama led America into a new kind of war, one in which there were no U.S. troops on the ground, some CIA agents we know, but no U.S. boots on the ground, one with international support, one in which he did not go to Congress for permission because, as he said, there were no U.S. troops on the ground. And yet one in which we really don't know the outcome. You quote a senior administration official saying the question is what demons are waiting that we don't know yet are there. How do you respond to that?
Right. No, I think we don't know. We don't, in any of these situations, you never know how it's going to pan out. And there's so many resentments and hatreds and things that bubble up, different score settling that goes on. And it is going on already in Libya now. And the question is, you just sort of hope, and I mean, hope is not much of a foreign policy strategy, but in these sorts of situations, you know, I think the best bet for us and for the international community is to try to continue to support this opposition party, the rebels, try to support hopefully the more Western-inclined elements in it, but also support the Islamists as well and help them set up a stable pseudo-democracy that is at least on the step towards joining what the so-called normalized international community.
Well, and as you say, all told, whatever demons lie ahead, America for once will not be solely responsible for having unleashed them or for exorcising them.
That's exactly it. I mean, look, in Afghanistan, one of the greatest faults of the president's strategy is that we had this sort of international community supporting it, and then we made it America's war. In Iraq, obviously, famously, we said, you know, international community be damned, we're going to head with this and look at the consequences in both those places. And in this case, in Libya, you know, the French were into this, the British were into this, the Italians were into this, other Arab countries were supportive of this. So any of the catastrophically bad things that could go wrong, it's not going to be Washington's fault.
Michael Hastings, one last quick question. You paint an incredible picture, again, from the, you know, people who were there, of one of Gaddafi's son's reactions when he made that speech on March 17th, I think, saying that he would hunt down the rebels and show no mercy. And you say his son, Saif, who has been to the States, who has worked with consultants here, and he leapt into his Jeep and raced to his father's house and pled with him, you know, please withdraw that threat. He, Saif, also tried to arrange a phone call to Hillary Clinton, to the Secretary of State. She refused to speak with him. And there's this one scene of him staring out a window and saying to this, small circle of remaining supporters, "We gave up our nukes and they screwed us." I'm just wondering, from what you heard of what happened inside the war room, was there any sympathy expressed on the part of the Obama administration for Muammar Gaddafi, who had, you know, come in from the cold somewhat, you know, had committed horrible offenses, but had come in from the cold somewhat? Was there anything expressed in that room about, you know, trying to get him out, you know, trying to save him?
I don't think there was any sympathy at all. There were arguments to be made that, look, you know, he has been playing ball on the war on terror. He has been playing ball on weapons of mass destruction. Do we really want to go around messing with that government?
Well, but in the end, you know, one could say he and his sons brought it on themselves.
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, there's not going to be too many tears shed for Muammar Gaddafi. And the regime insiders I spoke to who told me those scenes of the sons and how they're responding, they blame Gaddafi. They say Gaddafi thought we were bluffing. Gaddafi thought he could poke the tiger in the eye yet again. They were shocked. Saif, as well as Muammar Gaddafi, according to my sources, were absolutely shocked when the bomb started. And they, as the war dragged on, they had convinced themselves that they were actually going to be able to win up until the last moment. And I didn't get this in the story, but there was this very poignant moment in August, right before Tripoli fell, where one of my sources was speaking with Saif, trying to cut a peace deal, because the French had been putting out secret peace deal offers that they would deny this. And Saif Gaddafi said, "I'm not going to cut a deal with the French. I'm only going to cut a deal with the Americans," which was delusional because it was clear that, you know, Washington was not going to be cutting any deals.
That's Michael Hastings. His story about President Obama's decision to intervene in Libya appears in Rolling Stone. There's a link at herenow.org. His upcoming book about the war in Afghanistan comes out in January. Michael, put us on your dance list then.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And a quick news note, 22 wounded Libyan rebels have arrived at Spalding Hospital in Salem, Massachusetts. The State Department helped with their transfer here. The Libyan National Transitional Council is paying for the care. The men are seriously injured, but on a lighter note, they are arriving in America on Halloween in Salem, Massachusetts. Which city? They were told on the flight over, "Don't worry, everyone will look normal by Tuesday." Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
the Institute of Contemporary Art, Boston, presenting Dance Draw, an exploration of art and performance, on view now, icaboston.org. And Philips Healthcare, dedicated to improving access, managing costs, and helping clinicians improve care globally, at philips.com/healthcare.